I'm deeply grateful to Julie Silverman and to her wonderful husband, Rav David, for inviting me to come to speak to all of you tonight. I would like to thank once again, as I did in the reception, Gabriella Bachrach for all her tremendous work and the effort of putting this program together. And once again, I thank Mr. Ben Hirsch for inviting me, for giving me the personal tour, for being a friend for many years, and for also using my story in the picture in the museum. I don't need it. Give me the tape up here. Many of us here have heard of the great Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Mordechai Gifter, who was a brilliant Talmud Chacham. If you ever had the opportunity to speak to him or to listen to him speak, you knew that the fire of Torah burned in his heart and burned in his soul. And he was asked to lead the Tel's Yeshiva when it was going to open up a branch in Israel in the town called Telstone. Rabbi Gifter came to Eretz Yisrael, and the first time that he was there, he was there in the middle of the week, came Friday morning, he went to the Kaisal Maravi, to the Western Wall, to the Wailing Wall, and he went to Kever Rachel, the tomb of our mother, the matriarch Rachel. That night, Friday night, he was sitting with a group of Bochrim, a group of young fellows who were studying in yeshiva. And there was one fellow, Rabbi Yerachmiel Chassid, who asked Rabbi Gifter, he said, "Have you been to the wall? Have you been to Kever Rachel, to the tomb of Rachel?" And he said, "Yes, it happens to be that today I went there, and I was there, this was the first time that I was in both places." So Rabbi Chassid says to Rabbi Gifter, "Which place moved you more? The Wailing Wall, the Kaisa Maravi, or the tomb of the matriarch Rachel of Kever Rachel?" And Rabbi Gifter said, "I was very moved by Kever Rachel, but I was much more moved by the Kaisa Maravi, by the Wailing Wall." And Rabbi Chassid said, "Wow, that surprises me, because I have asked this question to so many people, and invariably everyone says that they were more moved by Kever Rachel, by the tomb of Rachel. Why is it that you, Rosh Yeshiva, you are more moved by the Kaisa Maravi?" And Rabbi Gifter shed a tear and said, "Junge Leute, young people, is that doch alle jung, if I state it. You're all so young, you don't understand. You're young people. You can relate to a mother. You can relate to your mothers who worked for you, who toiled for you, who davened for you, who cried for you. So you could relate to Mama Rachel. You could relate to the mother Rachel crying for her children and Hashem telling her, Mini koilech mi bechi ve'enayich min dima. Take away your voice from crying and stop shedding tears, because there's hope for your people. But all of you, you never saw the world before destruction. You never saw destruction. You never saw a world after destruction. You're also young. You have no appreciation. But I learned in Tells. I learned in the glory of the great yeshivas. I saw the greatest Gedolim, the greatest Torah scholars. I saw the month of Elul, the month of trepidation in yeshivas as they prepared for the high holidays. I understood what a yeshiva bacher is. We know after all that was destroyed, I saw the destruction. And we know that every ounce of destruction is based on the destruction of the holy temples. And so I saw what it was before destruction. I saw what it was after destruction. That's why the Kaisa Maravi, the Wailing Wall that typifies that ultimate destruction that we had in Klal Yisrael, that's why that moved me more. Tonight, we come to honor people who saw what it once was, who remember the glories of what Judaism was once all about, and then who suffered the destruction. Just like Rav Gifter said, young people cannot appreciate what the world was because they never saw it. But Bert Lewin, Pola Arbizer, Ben Hirsch, and Cantor Gutfreund, they saw, they suffered, they remember, and they teach us. And that's why we came here tonight, and that's why we thank you, and we learn from you, as we said before. We have to make a connection to the past so that we should be able to understand the future. And that's exactly what Bert Lewin wrote in his book, in his beautiful book, On the Run in Nazi Berlin. He writes, "I write my book so that my sons and daughters will pass my story on to their children, and they to their children, so that the knowledge of the Holocaust will become a legacy binding the generations together, never to be forgotten." That's why we come here tonight. As we said earlier, Rav Shach once said, the great Dean of Panovich once said, the Jew is not tied to the past. He cannot hope to be connected to the future. So I want to share with you an experience, a very painful experience that happened just a few years ago. In the summer of 2004, and then again a few months ago, before Rosh Hashanah, I took a group of 120 people, and we went to Poland, and we went to Auschwitz. Now, those of you who have never been to Auschwitz, it's absolutely a disgrace what they have done to our memory. You hardly see the word Jews there. As if the Jews were just among other people that were killed. Nobody mentioned that most of the Jews that were killed and tortured and burned there, most of the people there were Jewish people. You come into Auschwitz, you come into the parking lot, and there's smiling tour guides. You're expecting them to sell popcorn and peanuts. And that attitude that those guards and those guys had, I was not going to let them speak to our people. I was going to tell them what the Torah view of how we should look at those people who died and survived in Auschwitz. And so, they were just upset, but it was nothing they could do about it anyway. I wasn't going to let them lead the tour. I was going to lead it. Because I felt with their attitude and where they came from, they could not possibly understand how a Torah Jew should understand what went on here. And I told all that gathered, the Torah tells us that when Yaakov Avinu, when our patriarch Jacob found out that his son Yosef was still alive, that his son Joseph was alive in Egypt, the verse tells us, Vayomer Yisrael, Yisrael, that Yaakov said, Rav, it is great, Oid Yosef ben Chai, my son Yosef is alive, Elcha ve'erenu b'terem omos, let me go down and let me see my beloved son before I die. So Rashi tells us, Rav, what does it mean? It is great. I have so much happiness. I never thought that I would live to see my son again. So when the Pasuk tells us, Vayomer Yisrael, Yaakov said, Rav, Rav means an abundance of joy. But that's not how the Midrash understands it. Listen to how the Medrash understands it, and then we'll understand how to look at these four guests of honor and the other Holocaust survivors that are here tonight and that exist in this world. Vayomer Yisrael, Yankov said, Rav, Rav, Koichei Shel Yosef Bini. Rav means it is great. He is greater than I am. Yosef, my son, is greater than I am. Why? Shekamet Sarai Tegiyu. He had so many problems in his life. V'adayin hu oimed b'tzidkai. He went through the problems with his brothers. He went through the problems with Potiphar. He went through all different terrible trials and tribulations in life. And yet, hu oimed b'tzidkai, he is still righteous. He is still committed to all that we believe. Harba mimeni. He is greater than I. That's what it means when Yosef, when Yaakov said about his son, Yosef Rav, doesn't mean that Yaakov was happy. It means that he realized that his son is greater. And that's what I feel. That's what I told all those people. All those people who went through the Gehenna of Auschwitz, So many of them threw away their religion. Who's blaming them? It's not for us to say. But those that maintained it there, and those that maintained it today, Rav, they are greater than us. They are our leaders. They are our heroes. Because they could have thrown it away, and they didn't. And they show us what it's all about. Let me tell you a dramatic story that the Blucher Rebbe used to tell over at every bris that he went to once he was saved from the Holocaust. He told over that he was one day chopping wood with a whole group of people, and they were near where the train station was. And he could hear on the train terrible cries. He said those cries pierced the heavens. It was the crying of young mothers and children that were being brought in a transport. And they all realized what was going to happen to them. And then as the woman and the women were carrying the little children, there was a woman that comes over to the Rebbe, and she says to him, "Give me a messer, give me a knife." And the Rebbe says to her, "My daughter, my daughter, don't do anything to yourself like that. You have to try to live as long as you can." And the Nazi soldier that was walking by saw there was a discussion. So he said to the Rebbe, "What does she want?" And the Rebbe was afraid to say, because that night, that German Nazi, he'd probably give her a knife. He'd love to see her kill herself. But he was carrying a bayonet. He was carrying a small knife in his chest pocket. And the woman took out the knife from his pocket, and she unwrapped the package that she had. It was a little boy. And she takes the little boy, and she performs a bris. She says, "Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech ha'olam, asher kidishonu b'mitzvoseinu v'tzivonu al hamila." And she circumcised the child. And she says to God, "God, you gave me a healthy child. I'm returning to you a kosher yid." That's the Mesiras Nefesh. Rav, these people were greater than us. Did it ever occur to anybody that two forks are eight candles in a menorah? People in Auschwitz, when it came Hanukkah time, how were they going to light candles? So they took two forks, and every night they would put some paraffin, some wax on one of the top, one of the prongs of the fork. So by the eighth night of Hanukkah, they had two forks. That was the eight candles of Hanukkah. Or how about the lady Esther Fleischman? Her relatives in England told me she was dying, and she asked for some water. And they had to go out at night because there was no water in the barracks. And somebody risked their life to get her a little cup of water. And they thought for sure she'll drink the water. And then Esther says to them, "No, I don't want to drink the water. I just want to wash my hands." It feels like an Ayim Shvart. She wants to say Shema Yisrael. So she washed her hands with that ounce of strength that she had. Not that she wanted to drink. She knew she was going to die. But she wanted to say Shema Yisrael with purity. So she washed her hands and she said Shema Yisrael. And in the middle of Shema, she passed away. And what about those people who bribed the guards so they should be able to get a little bit of flour, so they should be able to get some matzah for Pesach? Rav, those are people. Those are the people that we look up to. Those are the people that we have to follow. We live in a country where so much is available to us. As we said before, those people, they died. Al-Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name. We have to make a commitment tonight that forever we will live Al-Kiddush Hashem. I remember when I went with this group from England, there was a cantor that was with us, just like Cantor Good Friend. And we went down to Birkenau. And it was already the twilight, the red sun set in the background. And he sang the Kel Malei Rachamim. Pierced everyone's heart. Because his parents, Nebuch, grandparents, he had lost his grandparents there. And then we marched. Everybody sees that picture that Ben has hanging, the tower. We took that long walk. It must be a half a mile. We all walked quietly after that service. And then we came into one of the barracks. We came into one of those cold barracks where our forefathers never slept in crowded quarters. And I had told a fellow from England, I said to him, "I want you to bring your guitar because we're going to sing here." And he says, "What are you talking about? English guys don't sing." I said, "You don't understand. It's not that I'm an American and you're an English guy. We all have Yiddish hearts. You watch. We'll start singing, and you'll sing and sing and play like you never played before. And we started singing in that cold barrack at night. It was totally darkness. And we started singing, Av Yisroel Chai. You can't imagine that dance. You can't imagine they were screaming on top of their lungs. Ashreinu matoim chalkeinu umayofa Yerushaseinu. Ashreinu, how lucky we are to be such a nation. And they danced, and no one wanted to leave except that the buses had to take us back so we could catch the plane back to England. And then somebody calls me up a couple days later from England, and he said, I want you to know, I didn't tell my father that I was going on this trip, because he lost his father there. I felt it would be too painful. But after we sang in those barracks, and we showed the world, and we showed ourselves that we have come back, that we have survived, and that we will go on in the future, I called my father, and I said, your father didn't die in vain. Your father died, but we live, and we're going to continue, and we're going to build, and we're going to grow from it. You read Mrs. Paula Arbus' book, and it breaks your heart. One part that is so sad. There was a Gestapo fellow that wanted to teach his family how to ride horses. And so Paula had to work in the riding school. She carried bricks, building up the walls, so that the horses should be able to jump over. And Nebuch, a lot of girls her age, also had to build those walls where the horses would jump over. And the Gestapo and his family, they would practice the horse riding. And then there was a guy across the street, also a German, Yamach Shemoy, who wanted to teach his family target practice. So they would shoot from the roof across the street, and Nebuch, a few of Paula's friends, were just killed in cold blood because they were the aim of target practice. And when I thought about that, I thought about another place where I went. When I went with this group, we went to a place called Theresienstadt. Theresienstadt is one of the places where the Red Cross was brought, because that's where they had plays, and that's where they had soccer games, and that's where they deceived the whole world. Because they tried to show, you see, the Jews are doing fine. They're having theatrical plays, and they're having soccer games, so it's nothing bad. And the world fell for it. They didn't know about Dachau. They didn't know about Bergen-Belsen. They didn't know about Mattenhausen. They didn't know about Auschwitz. They didn't know about Majdanek. But they only knew about the Theresienstadt. But what they didn't realize, and what we saw, is you walk between two buildings, and there's a hidden shul, and this was a life-changing moment for every one of us that was in that shul. Because nobody realized that it was a shul. And there was a chazan who was a great artist, and he wrote words that are only now becoming apparent, because the Nazis after the war covered it over with paint, and now the paint is peeling. So now they are making that a hidden treasure, a tourist attraction. And in there you have, we all stood there and we sang Kalbach's Nigin, Habet Mishamayim Ra'ei. Look, and these were the words on that wall. The Chazan had painted them to give encouragement. Habet Mishamayim Ra'ei. It's a plea begging Hashem, take a look at us. We are the scorn and the derision of the nations. They shoot at us. Target practice. We are like sheep that are led out to the slaughter, to be killed, and to be lost, to be hit and for shame. And throughout all this, we did not forget your name. And if we didn't forget your name, Hashem, no, you don't forget us. And again, in that hidden shul, we all sang and we danced. And that dance was a dance of Kedusha. If you see the video or the CD-ROM of that dance, you see people crying on the wall. They just can't stop crying. Because they knew that at the end we won. At the end, they tried to get rid of us, but they could never get rid of us. Because Klal Yisrael is Am Yisrael Chai Le'olam Vo'ed. Am Yisrael is here forever. We may not all here be together, but the segment of Klal Yisrael that exists will teach the rest of Klal Yisrael their role and their goals in life. Tonight, we heard the beautiful renditions of the Chazan. I want to tell you about another incident that happened in Prague with all of us. In Prague, if any of you have ever been there, there's something called the Charles Bridge. On the Charles Bridge, there is something that I told the people in advance, I want you to know this exists, but I don't want anybody to take any pictures. Because I don't think it's appropriate for a Jewish person to take a picture of this, but I want you to know about it anyway. If you walk on the Charles Bridge in Prague, there are many statues along the bridge. It's a walking bridge. It's not for cars. And when every moment of the day, there are thousands of people on that bridge. And there's a big crucifix on that bridge. And in 1600, 1604 to be exact, some Yid who thought he was a Chacham, and he wasn't a wise man, he was anything but, he thought he's going to show that he's against the other religion. So he walks by this crucifix, which was there in 1604, and he spits or he kicks at it. And somebody saw him do it. Somebody from the government. They almost killed him. They almost made a pogrom. And the only way they were able to get out of it was that the Jewish people had to pay, listen to this, they had to pay in gold so that golden words would be written in a semicircular fashion, which is still there today. These words are on top of that crucifix. You could chalish. You could faint when you see it. Kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Hashem tzvokos maloi kol aretz kevodoi. The holiest word that we say, that Hashem is holy, Hashem tzvokos maloi, that is covered, that His glory is all over, that is over that crucifix. And it was there for hundreds of years. And then during the Second World War, after the Nazis stole it because they knew it was pure gold, so after the war, the Czech government was thinking, maybe we don't have to make the Jews do it again. After all, it was taken down. But they said, no, that's our landmark. So therefore, that's part of our tradition. So they forced the Jews to do it again, but this time it's gold-plated. But the Yidl who made it was a real chacham. And I pointed it out to the people, but again, I didn't want them to take a picture because I don't think a Jew has to take a picture of the crucifix. But you know, the Kadosh, the Dalet, is very sharp. It comes this way and then angles. But the Yidl who made it rounded it out a little bit in the corner. So it doesn't look like Kadosh, it looks like Karosh. If you take a look at the picture, you'll see very closely. Yeah, I'll fox them again. So what did we do? I gathered all the people there, and I told them the responsibility that a person has. One may not make a chilul Hashem to desecrate God's name, because if you do something that's a desecration to God's name, Jews can suffer for hundreds of years. So we all danced there again. Every day we danced. And we sang Am Yisrael Chai and Ashreinu Matzev Chokeinu, and we sang and danced until they threw us off the bridge. So Cantor, I hope you're going to forgive me, but I beg to differ with you. You wrote in your holy book, By Faith or By Faith, that one of the greatest moments of your life was when you were able to sing the Star Spangled Banner by Jimmy Carter. I beg to differ. I think the greatest moment of your life is what you did Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I want to read it to you. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. If the Nazis were to discover our hiding, at least we would be Jews until the last moment of our lives. So the five men led by the Chazan crowded in the corner and our backs to the crucifix on the wall, and we began our prayers. And he led them in Kol Nidre, and he led them in Shema Yisrael. Chazan, that's the greatest moment of your life. You know why? Because the Torah tells us, what is the ultimate Kiddush Hashem? The ultimate sanctifying of God's name is among the Jews themselves. Of course, you have to make a nice impression on the nations of the world. We understand that. But Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name to inspire another Yid and say, I want to be like that Yid. I want to be an elevated Yid. V'nigdashti b'soich b'nei Yisrael. So I hope you moichel me, but I think your greatest moment was that moment, and that's why we're here today. Carter could have got anybody else. I'm reminded of that which we daven every morning. We say every morning, V'chula mekablim aleihem, oil malchus shamayim zemizeh. The angels proclaim that they accept the yoke of God. They give it over to each other, v'naisim ba'ava. They give it with love, lahadish liyotzram, to sanctify their Creator. That's what you did, Chazan. When you davened and you showed your love for Hashem, how you inspired not only those five, but their children and grandchildren and all of us here today. I want to share with you a story that, as Rabbi Silverman mentioned earlier, I usually don't write a story unless I check it out numerous times, either with the people that were there or people who witnessed it. So a woman today in Muncie, her name is Esther Beller, but when this story takes place, the night before Kristallnacht in Berlin, she was a little 12-year-old girl. Her name was Esther Cohen. And Esther told me the story, that every night on the radio, they were hearing that there might be a terrible pogrom, and they might come and take Jews, and kill Jews, and who knows, loot the stores. But they had heard it many, many times. So after a while, people didn't run anymore, because they would run, and then 2 days later, they came back. But this time, when Esther Cohen's parents heard about it, they thought, this time it's for real. Because the neighbor upstairs who was not Jewish told them, we heard it on the radio that the generals are ordering the police to look away. So I'm telling you, for your own sake, you should run. So they had in-laws on the other side of town, and it's hard to imagine, but you know, stories happen. The parents went to the other side of town with the other children. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And Esther said, I'll come there in an hour. Don't worry about me. I'll be okay. Because I have some homework to do. I have all my books here. And I'll come later on. So the parents went to the other side of town. And Esther stayed home. And she told me a half hour later, all of a sudden she heard yelling and screaming, and she saw a mob coming down the street towards her apartment house. Her parents had a store on the first floor. And she heard people say, yell, kill the Jews, get the Jews, and they started looting and rioting and hitting everybody in the way and destroying the whole Jewish quarter where all the shops were. And she was terrified because they were coming down the street. They were going house to house. Who knows what they could do if they find a Jewish girl. So she told me that many people had told her that she really didn't look Jewish. She had a very fair complexion, and she had blondish hair. So she told me that she went to where there was a mirror in the house. She said she's embarrassed that she did this, but she felt she had to save herself. So she tussled her hair in the way that the Nazi girls wore it, and she had a blouse, and she opened up the blouse, two buttons, and she took out her shirt. She should look trampish just like they did. And she figured she'll walk outside and she'll walk among them. They wouldn't even dream that this is a Jewish girl. And maybe like this she'll be able to get away those 2 blocks and then she'll run to the other side of town. She was so embarrassed that she was going to do this, but she did it anyway because she felt she had to save her life. And she starts going down the stairs. And all of a sudden she remembered something that her mother once told her. And she said it to me in Yiddish. I'll tell it to you exactly how she heard it, and then we'll translate. She said, my mother used to tell me, afilo by the fear vent af mezach shemen. That means, even among the four walls in your house, you have to be embarrassed about how you look and how you dress. A person has to dress modestly and walk modestly in the house, even among the four walls, when nobody is there. And she told me, she started thinking, why did she think of that all of a sudden right now? Her mother had told it to her years ago. She hadn't thought about it in years. Why all of a sudden now did she think about it? She said, if God made me think about it, then there must be a reason. I can't go out looking like a Nazi girl. So she didn't change her hair, but she buttoned her buttons to the top, and she tucked in her shirt. And she said, come what may, I'm going out like a modest girl. But I'll walk nonchalantly, I'll say any tillim, any psalms that I know by heart, and I'll pray, and hopefully everything will be well. So now she walks out, her skirt, her blouse is tucked in the skirt, the button is closed, and she walks, and they're yelling and screaming, and they disregard her because all they want to do is loot and yell and scream and kill. And she really didn't look like a Jewish girl. And she's able to walk through this whole mob, And after about 5 minutes, which seemed like about 5 hours, she was able to run to the other side and run to the other side of town. She runs to the other side of town, and she comes in to where her grandparents were. She wasn't sure if her parents made it there. And she runs in, and she sees her mother, and she's so overwhelmed, and she falls on her mother, and she cries, and she can't stop crying. And finally, she tells her the whole thing that happened, how she was going to walk with the open blouse and the tucked-out shirt. And then she closed it because she remembered what the mother said. And the mother says to her, "Esther, don't you realize you saved your life?" She says, "Mama, what are you talking about?" She says, "Open up your shirt. You're wearing a necklace that has the Mug and Dovid on it. Could you imagine if you would have walked out with the button open and they would have seen the Mug and Dovid? They would have killed you on the spot. So your modesty and your Ehrlichkeit and your sensitivity saved you." And that's what the girls in Tamim are all about. Modest, Ehrlich, and sensitive. And for all those Esther Cohens that were saved, and all those type that were lost, we come here today to say that we're going to build a nation. We're going to build mothers and grandmothers in Klal Yisrael that will be those type of girls that we will be proud of. That's what the true Bat Yisrael is all about. As one of the girls mentioned, Mr. Ben Hirsch, the night of the Kristallnacht, I want to quote exactly the painful goodbye that he writes about so movingly. He writes, "We left for Paris in the Kinder transport on December 5th, 1938. I still remember seeing Mom cry at the Bahnhof at the train station as she put us on the train. My older brother and sister cried too. But I was so excited about my trip to Paris, I could not fathom anyone's sadness. That's the last time I saw my mother. If I had understood, I would have cried as well." So Ben came, and as he told me over the phone this past week, and as he writes in his beautiful book, he was placed in a camp in France. And he's gone back to that camp. He's tried to find that camp. Because in that camp they did terrible, terrible things to the Jewish children. They made Ben cut his tzitzis. And they made Ben, they tried to force him to eat ham, to take away any vestige of Judaism that any of the children might have. And when I heard about that cruelty, how could you be so cruel to little children? It occurred to me another incident that was told to me by the person to whom it happened. And I told this also in the barracks in Auschwitz. There was a man in Brooklyn who donated a Sefer Torah to a shul. And they made a very big ceremony when he donated it. And there was a tremendous story that went with it. And I called him up and I said, "Sir, would you mind telling me that story?" And he says, "Rabbi, why do you want to make me tell that story? I haven't slept in 55 years. Why do you want to make me tell that story over?" I said, "Sir, if you don't want to tell it to me, I understand. I'm not going to push you." But as we spoke, then the story came out. See, he went to his rabbi. And this is a man who sits in the back of the shul. He doesn't have a lot of money. You know how much it costs to write a Sefer Torah today? Over $20,000. So the rabbi said to him, "Where do you have money to have a Sefer Torah written that you want to donate it to the shul?" He said, "Rabbi, this Sefer Torah is being written for years already. Every time that I had some money, I gave it to the scribe. I gave it to the sofer. Call him up, you'll see. I've been paying him for years, and now it's finished, and I want to donate the Sefer Torah." And the rabbi called the scribe. And sure enough, the scribe told him he's been paying for more than 15 years for this Sefer Torah. And they made a tremendous ceremony. On a Sunday afternoon, they marched it under a chuppah, as you know, with music and dancing. And then they asked the man, "Why did you donate the Sefer Torah? What possessed you to do such a beautiful thing?" And listen to what he said. He said, "When I was 15 years old, I was taken with my father and my brothers and my sister. We were taken to concentration camps. And everybody was killed except for me. And I had no memories. I had only memories. I had nothing left tangible from my father. No pictures, nothing. The only thing that I had for my father was a pair of boots. He gave me a pair of leather boots. And wherever I went, I always wore them because that was my only connection, my physical connection to my father. And he said, one night I was lying in the cold barracks and I had my boots on. And a Nazi soldier comes inside and he sees my boots and he grabs them off my foot and he says, these are mine now. He says, I started crying. I couldn't stop crying because now I had nothing. This was the last vestige of a memory of a connection that I had to my father, these leather boots, and now he took that as well. And I was freezing. I froze that night. And the next morning I went out barefoot. I went out on the street there, and I happened to recognize that soldier. Now I knew there was no way he was going to give me back the boots. So I said to him, please, sir, could you please get me a pair of shoes? I can't walk this way. I'm barefoot. So the soldier said, wait here 5 minutes. I'll bring you back a pair of shoes. 5 minutes goes by, and sure enough, the Nazi Yamach Shemai comes back with a pair of shoes, and he gives it to this boy. He told me, I sat down on the floor, and I was about to put my foot into the shoe, and then I noticed that the instep, where you normally have the leather, where you put your foot in, the instep was cut out of the parchment of a Sefer Torah. And every time that I put my foot in that shoe, I felt I was disgracing Hashem's Torah. And I knew that I had no choice because I had to survive. But I swore to myself that if I ever get out of this place, one day I'm going to give God back a Sefer Torah. And I'm going to give God a Sefer Torah with honor and glory for all that honor and glory that I took away from him. Did this man take away honor and glory from the Sefer Torah? He had no choice. He feels he trampled on a Sefer Torah. He trampled on God's Torah. Of course he didn't trample. But on a night like this, when we get together, on such a special night, we have to ask ourselves behind closed doors, do we ever trample on God's Torah? The lives that we lead, the things that we say, the things that we watch, the way we conduct ourselves, are we trampling on God's Torah? This man felt he trampled on God's Torah and he wanted to pay back. Tonight is the night that we have to make a commitment. From now on, we will not trample on God's Torah no matter what the situation is. We will elevate God's Torah. We will do everything to learn His Torah, to observe His Torah, and to teach it to others, to our children, and to our grandchildren. The theme of tonight is to look at the past, to make a connection to the future. And so I just want to end with this magnificent story. This was told to me by the Avigdor family. Rabbi Yaakov Avigdor, in 1940, was a wonderful Rav in Hungary. He had four children, two boys, two girls, and a wife. And Nebuchadnezzar, they came to Hungary in those years, and they took all of them. The girls, Nebuchadnezzar, lost right away. And within a year or two, the father and the boys were able to survive, but his wife, Nebuchadnezzar, was killed. And then one day, there was an action, as it was called. And they took the boys and they tried to separate the boys from the father. And the father didn't want to be separated from his boys. That's all he had left in his life. But no matter what he tried to do, the Nazis pushed them apart. And as the father went to the left and the boys went to the right, the father called out to the older boy, Yitzchak. He said, Yitzchak, take care of your young brother, Avram Ber. I can't take care of him. They're not letting me take care of him anymore. But it's your responsibility. Please, take care of your younger brother. And they never saw each other again. And Yitzchak and Avram Ber, these boys, they were taken to Mattenhausen. They were strong boys at the time. So they were put into a labor camp. And they were able to survive. They were there for a number of years. But they were strong. But of course they became very emaciated. But eventually they were able to go out. And after the war, they went to a place, Bergen-Belsen, which became a DP camp. And at the DP camps, people tried to get visas, tried to get some permission to go to some country that would accept them. And people would come from all the other camps trying to find out if they had any relatives that had survived. And one day, the older boy Yitzchak, he sees a girl who he recognizes. It's the Chazan's daughter. It's Pesha from his hometown near Deborah Tzim. And he says, Pesha, what are you doing here? She says, I'm looking for my husband. I've gone to camp, to camp, to camp. I'm looking for my husband. I don't know where he is. I don't know if he's still alive. And Yitzchak knew that he had been killed. Yitzchak saw that he had been killed. And how in the world is he going to tell this young woman who is waiting for hoping beyond hope that maybe her dear husband is still alive? But he has to tell her because she has to go on with her life. He says, Pesha, I feel so terrible to tell you. But I remember one time that he was brought on a firing squad and he was killed. And they knew each other. She knew that he would not say anything that wasn't true. And she started crying and screaming. And she said, my life is over. I can't go on with my life. My life is finished. He was my whole life. I was waiting, going from place to place, hoping to find him. And of course, he let her cry. How could you not let a woman cry? Such terrible news. And the next morning, she said, I'm getting out of here. I'm going away. I'm finished. And he said, listen to me. Listen to me. Someday you might want to remarry. And no rabbi is going to let you marry unless they have positive proof that your husband died. That was the Aguna problem. Those that are never tied because they never had proof that their husbands actually died. He said, I'm going to give you a letter. Here, take this letter that I saw your husband die. Here, keep it. Take it with you. She said, I don't want it. Don't give it to me. I'm finished. I'll never remarry. And he said, don't be silly. And he forced it, and he put it into her pocketbook, and he forced it, and she left. Months go by. She's going from place to place like a lost soul. And finally, after a number of months, she comes to one of the DP camps. And there are a lot of young women there her age. And each one of them is going to the headquarters where the rabbis are, and each one is trying to get a written permission, a legal Judaic commission that they would be able to remarry. And each one is trying to show proof that their husband actually died so that they should be able to get a heter, a permission that they can marry. And she's waiting on this long, long line. And she's losing patience because she doesn't figure she's going to get married anyway. But anyway, she waits on this long line. And finally, after a few hours, she comes in front of the rabbi. And the rabbi says to her, what can I do for you? She says, she was married, and now she knows that her husband died. She wants to have permission in case one day she'll ever want to remarry. So he says to her, what kind of permission do you have? She says, what do you mean I have a letter? He says, what's a letter? Who saw it? And she takes the letter. She's so frustrated. She throws it down on the desk. And the rabbi takes a look. He says, where did you get this letter from? This is my son who wrote the letter. Where did you get this letter? And Rabbi Avigdor says, you saw my son? She said, yeah, of course I saw him. I saw him a few months ago. I'm Pesha. You don't remember me. I've changed, but I'm Pesha, the Chazan's daughter. He said, tell me, Pesha, you really saw my son? I can't believe it. And he starts making calls because his son, of course, was in one of the other DP camps. And he calls Dr. Yaakov Griffel. Dr. Yaakov Griffel was in the rescue unit, and he had the records of everyone. And Dr. Griffel tells him, you're right, your son is Tucker, he's in the other camp. And he sends him a letter, he sends him a telegram. And they make up that they're going to meet. He finds out that both his sons have survived. And they make up that they're going to meet.